raise. You could lower cholesterol without raising the BMR. And it was then suggested that perhaps the acetic acid analog had a different action on cholesterol and perhaps lipid metabolism in general from the hormones. Now, this idea gained a good deal of support when it was shown that the dextrose analog of thyroxine would also lower blood cholesterol without raising the basal metabolic rate. And I think that the excitement was fostered by the fashionable search at that time for compounds that would lower the serum cholesterol. Well, now, as you all probably know, D-thyroxine, which is biologically inactive, it's not a natural compound, it's synthetic. If given to a whole animal, it does not alleviate myxedema in any way. And yet, you see, here it is, behaving in a different way on blood cholesterol and on the BMR. Now, is this a real difference in the activity of some of these analogs? There are others besides the ones I've mentioned, the propionic acid analogs, which have also had quite a vogue. Is there any difference between those and the action of the thyroid hormone? And I think there's not. I think it's merely a question of suiting the dose to the effect. This was shown by Doniak, Trotter, and Hudson a few years ago. They administered triiodothyronine in tablets and triac in tablets to euthyroid patients with elevated cholesterol levels. In such a dose level, you can see from the slide behind me that the blood cholesterol fell. Can you see triac and T3 actually written on the curve? Well, both triac and T3 lowered blood cholesterol during the 3 months that they were administered. Neither T3, that's triiodothyronine, nor triac, raised the BMR. The thyroxine, they didn't get a suitably small dose. In fact, they gave too much. And although they got a lowering of blood cholesterol, they did get a rise in BMR. But I think we can forget about thyroxine for the moment because it's so difficult to dose. It has a cumulative effect, whereas the compounds with the short biological half-life, like triiodothyronine and triac, do not have a cumulative effect. But there you are, you see you have an active hormone, triiodothyronine, one of the more active, that you can dose it at such a level that it does not raise the BMR, but will maintain a lower blood cholesterol. And I think you can do that with any compound you like. But there's been a tendency, I think, to bias in this field, that the inactive compounds, I mean metabolically inactive compounds, were good things, because they wouldn't raise the BMR, perhaps give angina symptoms, whereas the metabolically active ones were bad things. And therefore, they weren't given a proper trial at a suitably low dose level. I do not, therefore, think that there are differential actions of thyroid hormones and analogs. Now, finally, I would like to say a very brief word, and it's really going to be brief, because we know so little about it, about what thyroid hormones do and how do they act. Could I have the next slide? Thyroidectomize an animal, its liver and kidney tissue, had a lowered respiration. If you made the animal hyperthyroid before killing it, the respiration of the tissues was increased. Now, that was fine as far as it went, but as soon as you took the tissues from a normal animal and added thyroid hormone in vitro, you could not get this effect. Most of the effects that have been found with thyroid hormone in vitro have not been of a stimulatory nature. You give a physiological dose, and by that I mean a dose that you might expect to find in the tissues or in the circulation, and nothing happens. You push up the dose till it becomes pharmacological or pharmacological to the end, and then the tissue just packs up. I mean, you don't seem to be able to reproduce the effects of thyroid hormones as they reach the tissue in the natural way by just adding them to the medium in your respiration experiment. And number one, the uncoupling of oxidative phosphorylation, which has been thought for some years by thyroid hormones, which has been thought for some years to represent a means of balancing oxidation of tissues and the formation of high-energy phosphate bonds, which represent the stored energy required for protein synthesis, etc. The thyroid hormone acted by keeping a balance between these two. Now, I think right from the beginning, there have been a number of objections to the uncoupling theory. Certainly, the high and toxic doses needed to produce uncoupling on mitochondrial system, to me, seems one of the insuperable objections. Why can't you make it uncouple, or why can't you produce an effect in vitro that happens in vivo? Well, the reason you can't, but that isn't the effect, I should say. That's a simple explanation. The other is the non-specificity of action. Compounds which have no physiological activity, such as the D-isomers of the thyroid hormones, are just as good in effecting uncoupling in vitro as is D-thyroxine. Well, that doesn't make sense either. If you can get uncoupling with a physiologically inactive compound, it means that you're not reflecting really what's going on when thyroid hormone does something at this target level. Other modes of action of the hormones have been involved with chelation with the metals which are known to be cofactors for certain enzymes, swelling of mitochondria, and increasing of permeability of membranes to substrates involved in oxidative processes. Now, I think it's getting late. We'll skip the next slide, because I've already said what are my objections to most of these mechanisms in vitro. And I'd like to very briefly mention some experiments that have been going on in Sweden, Tata, Amster, Lindberg, and their group. They have thyroidectomized animals and maintained them in two groups, either at the hypothyroid level or have administered chronic small doses of thyroid hormone to maintain them at a slightly hyperthyroid level. In these circumstances, in the hyperthyroid animals, they have found that oxidation and phosphorylation are both elevated in the mitochondria from liver and muscle. In other words, in the hyperthyroid rat, that is not uncoupling. There's an increase of both oxidation and phosphorylation. They've also shown what I think is very interesting, and that is that in the acutely hyperthyroid animal, that is the one given a very large dose, of thyroxin or triiodothyronine. Changes occur in mitochondrial and microsomal metabolism, which are almost immediate. I mean, you get an increased metabolism of a large number of substrates, you get an increased synthesis of enzymes, you get an increased incorporation of C14-labeled leucine, for instance, in the microsomal protein. And all these phenomena, these manifestations at the subcellular level in the microcells, in the mitochondria, occur long before there's any reflection of hormone action on the basal metabolic rate of the whole animal of a similar treated group. They have suggested that the effect of thyroid hormones on the BMR is not a primary one, but something happens in the cell or in the cell particles, because this particularly affects the particulate hormones, enzymes, which triggers off a series of actions, which is then reflected in an overall metabolic response. It's perhaps significant that the first response they find to thyroid hormone at subcellular level is this incorporation of labeled amino acids into microsomal proteins, especially when one thinks of the very important part played by thyroid hormones in protein synthesis during differentiation, as I mentioned before. I don't think I have anything further to say categorically, though I'd be quite pleased to answer any questions if you have any.
Body weight. So that you may be getting an effect
on cholesterol synthesis or lipid synthesis and metabolism, where you can't get an effect, you see, on this vast mass of muscle.
Now, where you lower the dose of thyroxine, where you got no appreciable effect on the heart, you still get a lower blood pressure.
Well, it's never been done, actually. You see, quite a trial. But in fact, I think there are two things to do with cholesterol, with thyroxine. Don't give it every day. If you give Triac or T3 every day, you know that by the time the patient takes the next step, the first one will have gone. If you give them thyroxine every day, you know that at the end of 4 days, they've got a pile-up of 3 days of cancer. So that in fact, you never know the level. Give thyroxine twice a week, and then I think you would find that you could get this apparent differentiation of effect between BMR and lipid metabolism.
One other question, which should maybe a bit field, because Dr. Van Middlesworth has been checking on the levels of radioactive elevation in the content of thyroids in the British Isles?
All that work, even in the British Isles, Dr. Van Middlesworth has done the work. I guess he's looking at the results.
Would you like to comment on thyroid role in blood glucose homeostasis?
Particularly the thyroid syndrome. As against thyroid cells, in what respect? I have said not a very obvious one, but I can't think of it. I think you probably know better than me, but I can't. What happens to the blood glucose in hyperthyroid?
Hyperglycemia
in bacteria. It has, but not as a regular finding.
Hypoglycemia.
It's been reported, but it's still a common feature in poison.
That's why I'd like to get it from our data.
Not from me. In London, now treat their patients with thyroxine. I think it's becoming more generally used, and it has a great advantage that it doesn't require any form of standardization. Now, there's an absolutely fascinating note from Dr. Boris Kapp in a recent sample of the New England Journal of Medicine, where he described educated thyroid with no thyroid-like activity. And I had a very similar sample, which was sent to me up to hours, which in the body prevention assay in rats affected their activity. So in fact, it will be caught by the standardization of the US Parliament here and the British Parliament. Either having a total iodine or a pyroxine iodine, whether it's used as well, but still having no physiological activity. And therefore, I can be forced to suggest that the only final test of dedicated thyroid is biological. The chemists just don't think they use what iodine is doing, except you don't have any what iodine, you carry your patient's functioning thyroid.
For many years here, most of us have thought that dedicated thyroid is adequate, that it's the cheapest medication. And in recent years, Dr. Van Nostrand and I have been interested in this problem and noticed that some patients don't respond to some of our prescriptions. And so we wondered whether we were, what the situation was. Dr. Van Nostrand made observations similar to one reported in an article he spoke of in the journal recently. And he also said that his observations could respond to T4. So we wondered if perhaps we should have changed that thinking to the reason they were in the pressure. He had made observations that were similar to the ones that were reported in the journal.
On the whole, I would say that this case of thyroid was pretty okay. But I do think that in case, I mean, as it has happened, the thing is to watch the patient for a little bit. You know, send them away to North Carolina or something.